This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. This is the third week of January, and this week, senators were sworn in for the impeachment trial of Donald Trump. We know who will be presenting the case against him, and we also know who will be defending the president, a team that will include Kenneth Starr and Alan Dershowitz. Frankly, we probably know pretty much how the senators are going to vote on conviction, but we don't know exactly what's going to happen between now and then, as senators continue to argue over the necessity of hearing from witnesses. Now, let's bring in our Left, Right, and Center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Matt Iglesias of Vox. Hello.
Hey.
Hey, Josh.
And our special guest this week is Felicia Wong, president of the Roosevelt Institute. Hello, Felicia.
Hey, Josh.
So we got a new report this week from the Government Accountability Office, the federal government's independent auditing arm. And the GAO says the Trump administration violated the Impoundment Control Act by delaying the disbursement of military aid to Ukraine. The Impoundment Control Act is a law that basically says when Congress tells you to spend money, you have to spend it. So, Rich, I feel like this gets at the heart of one of the key debates over impeachment, which is basically, were we arguing here over a policy dispute? Were people in the administration upset that the president was pursuing a Ukraine policy that they disagreed with, that a lot of people in Washington disagreed with? Or was there a matter of law breaking here? Was the president doing something that was beyond his legal authority? I mean, isn't this GAO report an important data point here in that, you know, we weren't just arguing over what the right policy is toward Ukraine, that the president was doing something illegal here and that's what people were reacting to?
Well, it gives the Democrats a hook because prior to this, they weren't able really to point to any violation of the law, and now they have an independent authority that says that Trump did violate the law, although I think this is very much in dispute and also would not itself be an impeachable offense. The GAO found, I believe twice previously, that Trump had violated the Impoundment Control Act. It found that George W. Bush at one point had violated this act, and I think fundamental problem with the GAO analysis is that there was a deadline to get the money out the door, and the money got out the door. So even if there's a technical violation, this doesn't seem to me like something you remove a president from office over.
Well, I mean, they did have to go back and get a stopgap bill from Congress that extended the appropriation on some of this money by a week or two. I mean, I think that, you know, you can say no harm, no foul, and the money got out, but it certainly seems to have had impacts on our relationship with Ukraine in the meantime. Matt, what do you make as we head into this trial? You know, you can have arguments over factual questions like this. It feels a little bit strange to me in that, you know, I don't think anybody is actually going to be engaged in too much fact-finding in the course of the trial.
Yes. I mean, you know, I think in a lot of ways, Senate Republicans view that they don't want to hear from witnesses because they've committed to acquitting Trump regardless of the facts or the law is like the most honest position that's out here, right? I mean, they did a gut check moment some time ago and they decided no matter what Trump does, right, if he takes money from military funds that hasn't been appropriated, uses it to build a wall, they love that. If he, you know, uses the FBI to conduct political purges, they're fine with that. That, like, whatever he does, it's fine as long as he backs them on core policy issues, which he does. They don't care about the Constitution, the law, the public interest, anything like that. So they might as well, frankly, just do the summary dismissal that, you know, some of Trump's biggest allies have done. There's no real point in pretending they have any interest in what happened here.
Rich, is that fair?
Well, I think actually most senators take this seriously enough that the House has actually done this, think they have to have a trial and hear the case. There wouldn't be more than 50 votes for dismissal. I do think the role of the Senate here effectively, even though Republican senators, most of them won't say it out loud, it's basically like an appellate court. They're making a ruling of law. They don't believe this rises to the level based on anything like these facts to impeachment and removal. The contradiction is a lot of them still say, well, nothing's been proved. So if nothing's been proved, well, then you should have witnesses and want to know, get further to the truth. The contradiction in the Democratic case is they also say, oh, we've got to find out the truth. Well, really, just you impeached them without knowing what the truth is. And I think it's transparently cynical and hypocritical what Pelosi has done, because she rushed the House impeachment because she wanted to not impeach an election year, because she wanted to avoid dragging out what's a painful process for some of her vulnerable members. And now they want to extend what the Senate does because it will be awkward for vulnerable Republican senators. And this is the way politics works, but let's be honest about what's happening here.
Felicia, what do you make of the way that Democrats have handled this in the last few weeks? I've personally been scratching my head a little bit at the delay that the House of Representatives took in sending the articles over. Do you see that there was a strategy there? What have Democrats gotten by dragging this process out a little bit after they, as Rich noted, did seem to be operating on a, you know, get this done by Christmas deadline?
Well, I think the Democrats have gained something on the witness front, because we have to remember it's not only about whether we have witnesses in the Senate trial, but also how those witnesses come up. Is it one by one? Is it a kind of tit for tat? Or is there going to be a broker deal with the whole group? And, you know, there are some signs that Speaker Pelosi's waiting was what led to more pressure for some Republican senators. We've got three right now. Maybe we'll have four. We've got Collins, Murkowski, Romney. I don't know, maybe Lee. So they might say yes to witnesses. They've indicated that, and I think that was part of what Speaker Pelosi was gaming out here.
Do you think that the Democrats gained anything in the delay, Matt?
It's a little hard to know the counterfactual. I, like many people, found this strategy a little bit puzzling, but she seems to have held her caucus together, which is always her top goal. I mean, as Rich said, right, like, this is politics. It's the United States Congress. But I think it's right to make it politics, right? It shouldn't be a political pain point for Democrats that President Trump broke the law, did something wrong, insists that there was nothing wrong with it, right? I mean, it would be interesting if what was going on here is that Trump's position was, look, in retrospect, we shouldn't have done this. It was wrong to have Giuliani over there. But at the end of the day, the aide went out, no harm, no foul. It's not an impeachable offense. But that's not what he's saying, right? Trump's position is that it is perfectly appropriate for him to sign laws, right, that Republicans and Democrats agree on, that he signs, and then to break that law, and to break that law not to advance a vision of American national interest, but to advance his personal political agenda. And he insists to this day that there was nothing wrong with doing any of that, and he was under no obligation to change course or do anything like that. And that should be a political problem for vulnerable Senate Republicans, right? The leader of their party is a crook with no respect for the rule of law, the foundational principles of the American Constitution, and it is appropriate for Democrats to try to manipulate the situation to make that politically embarrassing for Martha McSally, for Cory Gardner, for Susan Collins, because they should be embarrassed.
One thing that we did, I don't know if it was caused by the delay, but we certainly got it during the delay period, was the release of some of these documents that had belonged to Lev Parnas, one of the former henchmen to Rudy Giuliani. These are documents that Parnas got permission from a judge to turn over to Congress. Some of them have been made public. This includes a letter that Rudy Giuliani wrote to the then president-elect of Ukraine, Volodymyr Zelensky, basically saying, you know, I must request a meeting from you, and I want to make very clear that this meeting is solely in my capacity as the president's personal attorney. There are also these text messages where it looks like Parnas may have been under the impression that one of his associates was stalking the U.S. ambassador in Ukraine, Marie Yovanovitch, although it's maybe the guy was just delusional or boasting based on some of the context clues. But I mean, Rich, it seems to me that this undermines, again, one of the defenses here that's been key for the president, which has been, you know, that policy dispute defense, that whatever Giuliani was doing, yes, maybe he was not the right person to send over, but informal channels like this are sent over all the time historically in diplomacy. But this letter from Giuliani is saying explicitly that he's not a diplomatic channel, that he's there solely in the president's personal capacity.
Yeah, so as we've said before, at least I've said before, I don't think there'd be a problem, really. It would be, kind of underhanded tactics. Wouldn't be a problem with Rudy going there and trying to dig up dirt on the Bidens. The problem was the interaction of that enterprise with the official duties of the president of the United States. And with Lev Parnas in particular, we're back to kind of the Michael Cohen paradox, where the president's defenders could say, why are you going to believe this disreputable clown? And the president's critics justifiably are going to ask, well, why was this disreputable clown part of this effort in the first place? And I tend to believe everything he's saying about Giuliani and how Giuliani was keeping Trump in the loop. Where I get dubious is where he says Pence knew about the whole thing, and where I frankly don't believe him is when he throws out that Bill Barr was in on the whole thing. So this guy does have credibility problems, but the fact that this guy was part of such an effort on any level goes to the atrocious judgment of Rudy Giuliani and extending it out, Trump's poor judgment and having Rudy Giuliani as his personal lawyer.
Well, and so Felicia, I mean, what do you make of those documents that we've seen this week? In particular, the ambassador thing is remarkable to me. And as far as I know, we haven't seen anything out of the State Department as a reaction to it. The Ukrainians are going to be investigating whether any crimes were committed there. But we still don't seem to be seeing our government react with any sort of alarm to that.
Well, on this one, I have to agree with Rich. I mean, there is a real fact pattern here. And it's the combination of Michael Cohen and Paul Manafort and now Lev Parnas. You know, this really isn't justifiable behavior, and these are a lot of clowns in the circus. So I don't know much about, you know, the validity of these documents, really, and I'm expecting that the State Department's going to wait to figure out some of that before they comment. Maybe that's their excuse for not having said much up until now. But overall, this is what they call a bad look.
So, Matt, you were saying that this should be an awkward thing for Republican members of the Senate. Do you find it interesting, then, that some of the members for whom the trial is likely to be most awkward are the ones out there most open to the idea that there ought to be witnesses? I would think that if I were Susan Collins, I might want this thing over as quickly as possible.
Yeah, I mean, you might think so. I mean, Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski in particular have shown over the years, I think, an unusually high level of independent-mindedness. In Collins's case, in part because she's vulnerable. In Murkowski's case, she has an unusual personal history. I mean, Alaska is a very conservative state. So it's not super surprising that it's the two of them. I mean, I think you saw the other day Martha McSally, who's in a tough position in Arizona, you know, just like refusing to comment one way or the other on what she thinks should happen. Cory Gardner, for a couple of years now, has been like MIA on basically every topic under the sun. And that's because, you know, I think a lot of these guys don't really know what to do.
Rich, do you have a sense of what the discussion is inside the Republican Senate conference when we see these news stories saying that the White House expects a number of defections on calling witnesses? Do you think that's real? Is Mitch McConnell going to be unable to hold the caucus together on a very brief schedule for this trial?
I don't know, and I don't think McConnell knows what exactly is going to happen. His strategy is to have the opening arguments, you know, go into the second week and hope everyone in his caucus is tired of it by that point and ready to move on. I've been skeptical that there's going to be witnesses, in part because of the mutually assured destruction aspect of it. If the Democrats get Bolton, there'd be Republicans insisting the White House should get Hunter Biden or whomever. But I'm a little bit more, I think, you know, Bolton making a statement a couple weeks ago, the Lev Parnas stuff, it does create more pressure for witnesses and more pressure around Susan Collins, who, if there are witnesses, will kind of lead an effort. So it might be that there's some sort of compromise where each side gets two or three, but I would just tamp down people's expectations of what this is going to mean. It's probably going to mean the Senate deposes them, you know, and releases transcripts. We're not going to have a dramatic testimony, I kind of doubt, on the Senate floor. And also, you know, like the Lev Parnas thing, those documents, they really deserve further investigation. And the Senate is just not going to equip to do that in a trial. And this is, I think, another just bizarre aspect of this, where the pace of impeachment outran the pace of investigation in the House. So someone, a committee of Congress should be investigating this stuff still. But there was a rush to get the impeachment out the door for political reasons. So you have basically an incomplete impeachment inquiry.
Well, I don't know, though. I think the White House was obstructionist about those inquiries. And in some cases, they were exercising legal rights that they had. But I don't think that the White House can make both of those complaints at the same time. If the White House was undertaking a strategy that was going to make sure that it was impossible to complete those investigations in advance of the next election, then I think that it was reasonable for Congress to look at what it had and say, this is enough to go on. We have proved that the president abused his office, that the president committed impeachable offenses. And while there is more information we theoretically could obtain, we don't think the timescale is favorable for that. If the president really wanted to see more investigation because he thought it would exonerate him, he certainly had the option of being more cooperative there and trying to make it possible for Congress to complete that investigation. I think there are obvious reasons he wouldn't have wanted to do that.
Well, I mean, in the Clinton impeachment, Clinton had made all these same sort of privilege claims, and Ken Starr litigated out and won and got the witnesses and the documents. And this just goes back, Josh, I know I'm never going to convince you on this, but just a key forcing factor here was the looming election. Because the closer you get to election, the less sense it makes as a practical matter to have the Senate remove a president when the public is going to be allowed to make their judgment. So they couldn't complete the investigation because they didn't want to impeach him, you know, in May or June.
Felicia, I want to ask about one political aspect of this, which is that to the extent that the trial is ongoing, it's going to keep U.S. senators who are running for president off the campaign trail. Do you think this matters at all for Iowa and New Hampshire, that basically Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg get to campaign while Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren and Amy Klobuchar are stuck in the Senate chamber?
Well, not only are they stuck in a Senate chamber, but they're stuck in a Senate chamber for hours and hours in isolation, without any access to their cell phones, without any access to their staff. So they're kind of cut off from news of the outside world, which I just got to think at this point in the primary, it means something on the one hand. On the other hand, we've really seen that very little has made a lot of difference in the clustering and the bunching up of all the candidates in Iowa. It really is a jump ball at this point. So I guess we'll just see.
Let's take a quick break. I'll be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Matt Iglesias of Vox, and Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute to talk about trade and the candidates' debate. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Matt Iglesias, senior correspondent at Vox. And our special guest is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. On Wednesday, the president signed a so-called Phase One trade agreement with China. Perhaps the main significance of this agreement is that it's an agreement between the U.S. and China not to further escalate the trade war before the election. We are removing a small portion of the tariffs we previously imposed on the Chinese. They are making somewhat squishy commitments to buy more American products. This agreement comes at the same time the president's revision of NAFTA, the so-called USMCA agreement, is moving toward implementation. Felicia, the USMCA had strong bipartisan support in the Senate. There were only 9 Democrats voted against it, plus one Republican. The AFL-CIO has endorsed it. What did the president do in putting this deal together that has won so much support from the left?
Well, I think part of what the president did in putting this deal together was, you know, managing to time it. You know, the USMCA has been threatened to pass for months, even years, well, months. So part of it was just the timing vis-a-vis the impeachment, of course. But, you know, more broadly, I think the split amongst progressives on trade does make for pretty interesting politics. And it is one of the few places where we see some daylight between progressives. The thing that I'm most concerned about here is the degree to which the deal is really, really, really bad on climate. You know, the deal makes an exception for tar sands oil coming through the Keystone Pipeline from Canada. It makes an exception for oil and gas companies to be able to use certain provisions of the international regulations as a workaround when they don't like what their national governments are asking them to do. So this is not good. And I think it's one of the reasons that you've seen some senators, including candidate Sanders, object.
But so then what do you make of the fact that most of them did not object? Most of them have signed up for it. Elizabeth Warren has signed up for this. You know, a lot of people with really good progressive credentials have reached the opposite conclusion that you have about this deal.
Well, so I think on the other side, you know, Senator Warren did say in the debate the other night, there are Iowa farmers here who are hurting. I think that that is the calculation that President Trumka from the AFL-CIO made. So one of the ways to think about it is also what Senator Warren said in the debate. Are you going to think about the fact that this is pretty good, although imperfect, and you want to do better? That's one approach to politics and, frankly, one approach to governing. Or are you going to think about it the other way? Like, there was a lot better deal that we could have gotten, especially on climate, and you got to hold out for that. This actually says a lot about policy, but it also says a lot about the way these different candidates might approach executive power.
Matt, you just wrote the case for Bernie Sanders for Vox, arguing that he's the true unity candidate for the Democratic Party. And yet here he is sort of at least as measured by members of the U.S. Senate and in a significant minority with the party on this. Did Bernie make a mistake going against this trade agreement?
Well, you know, when you get an agreement like this that has such strong support, you then wind up getting a lot of position taking, right? I think every Democrat who looks at this deal sees the same thing, which is a win for labor groups and a loss for environmentalists. And then it's just sort of a decision of, like, do you want to be on the record as for it or against it? I think throughout Bernie's career, he has often broken with the party on these kind of votes. You know, something will happen like 90 to 10 and he'll be one of the 10. But then he's always been there on close votes, like for Dodd-Frank, for the Affordable Care Act, where it's the exact same calculus. He would say, like, this is okay, but not really what I want. And he votes for it when his vote is needed. What I think is really interesting about USMCA is that Trump managed to get free traders to vote for this when it is clearly a walk back. It's a small walk back, but definitely a walk back of NAFTA's free trade concepts. It brings in a decent dose of protectionism for the auto industry, which is why the AFL-CIO likes it. But Trump managed to win labor support that way, while also convincing, like, lots of Republicans who wouldn't ordinarily do that, that this is better than letting him blow something up or do something crazy. And it's a sort of unusual example of Trump doing, like, really savvy politics, where he took many Democrats' concerns seriously, addressed them, and then brought Republicans along.
Yeah, Rich, does that sound like an accurate description of what happened here to you? Because the only Republican who voted against this in the Senate was Pat Toomey, senator from Pennsylvania, who's a big free trade advocate, definitely doesn't like the extent to which this trade is somewhat a move away from free trade compared to the original NAFTA agreement. But it was really only Toomey who was willing to vote that objection among Senate Republicans.
Yep, I agree with Matt both on the analysis. It's a step towards protectionism, not an enormous step, but this is kind of a new version of NAFTA for people who didn't like NAFTA very much. And this was really cleverly handled, odd though that is to say, by the Trump administration from the beginning. Get the deal in the first place. There are these blustery threats, and very often his blustery threats aren't very well calculated, to get pressure Mexico and Canada at various times. And then he threaded this needle, as Matt says, by getting the Republicans on board because they feared something much worse, which is just be Trump ripping up NAFTA at some point if this weren't the replacement, while there are enough concessions in the deal to win over Democrats. So this is a true bipartisan accomplishment of this administration.
What do we make of the China Phase One deal? Is this important?
I find the idea of the president of the United States bargaining not for, like, policy concessions, but for this kind of industry by industry purchase agreement kind of disturbing. And it's something you've seen, I think, in a lot of Trump's approach to trade, where he has these tariffs, then he has this waiver process. And it's exactly what a traditional, like, free marketer would tell you, which is that, you know, you're not going to get some, like, idealized, here's how we can do protectionism in a way that makes everyone better off. You're going to see a lot of politicking and a lot of question about, you know, is the soybean industry happen to be politically significant so they get a win out of here, rather than any kind of, like, broad abstract principles. I don't think in practical terms it hasn't made, like, a huge difference on the price of global commodities. But as a concept of how the United States and China should relate, I think it's a little distressing.
Felicia, I mean, you have a Republican administration here taking seriously a problem that you heard about mostly from the left for a few decades, which is basically the idea that imbalances in global trade were really undermining the position of American workers, that we had a China shock that was really negative for incomes in a lot of parts of the country. Is it useful that the president is taking that seriously? Has what he has gotten out of his negotiations with China, is it moving in a productive direction on those concerns?
Well, Josh, you're right to point out that there are parts of left populism, especially left economic populism and right economic populism, that come together even conceptually. And this is one place. You know, Trump is obviously a confusing figure ideologically. He's done a lot that's like hardcore neoliberal, which we can talk about. But on this particular issue, he has long been a kind of populist. As to the question of whether or not it matters, I think it's important to note that the deal is really on the surface. It does not tackle the root causes of the trade war. It does not really deal with, you know, Beijing's mercantilist subsidies for many of its infant or homegrown industries. So, you know, at a structural level, relationships between China and the United States are probably going to look quite similar. But I do think, kind of like the USMCA, the deal could redound well for the president politically. He has a shocking ability to make a little into a lot.
Yeah, I think the purchases that China has agreed to make will probably peter out or aren't that meaningful because they're purchases that they would have made anyway. The intellectual theft mechanism looks fairly impressive on paper, but I just don't think there's going to be a big change here from China. The deal might be a sign that President Xi considers himself in a weaker position because it's basically the same contours of the same deal that the Chinese actually blew up last spring. But I think we're going to have another round of trade contention with China subsequent to this, some of it under the umbrella of national security concerns about China and technology.
I want to talk a little bit about the debate that happened this week among Democrats on Tuesday. We talked a little bit about positions that they have taken on the USMCA agreement. I thought it was interesting the way Joe Biden talked about trade with China. And basically, though he doesn't use these words, his implication is essentially that we ought to resurrect the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which was the trade agreement for countries around the Pacific Ocean that the Obama administration had negotiated that was supposed to be a counterweight to China. Support for it fell apart in the U.S. with attacks from both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. Felicia, is Biden right about that, that basically that we need these sorts of multilateral trade agreements in order to build coalitions that allow us to push back against China?
You know, I actually disagreed with the Obama administration at the time, and I continue to disagree with that approach overall. So, no, this is a disagreement on the policy, just this policy specifically. You know, I don't think that Biden was right to take that approach.
Matt, what do you think? Do we need a resurrection of the TPP?
So I would draw a distinction, right? I think the idea that the United States should negotiate a broad trade agreement with those kinds of countries as a geopolitical move in terms of economic and national security competition with China makes perfect sense. But when the Obama's negotiating team would sort of try to use that as a trump card against people who are raising concerns about the actual content of the agreement, right? And that's where all the questions are. It's like, why were all of the U.S. asks in that agreement so focused on the interests of the pharmaceutical industry and banks' desire to gain access to foreign financial services markets, right? I think the idea of trying to get, you know, Vietnam, Japan, Australia, those other countries into a trade partnership with the United States makes a lot of sense, but the content of the partnership still needs to make sense for middle-class Americans.
Rich, do you see if the president is reelected, the idea is that there should be a phase two agreement that follows this stopgap that the president has signed now. Do you see him having laid groundwork for that? You know, Felicia notes that this agreement is basically on the surface. What has the administration done that would position them in a second term to get concessions on those much more fundamental issues?
I think it just has to be the same, you know, threats and tariffs and question, you know, is it harder to go back and do that having done this first round and relaxed that pressure? But I tend to think that's what he would do. And I believe the approach that makes sense is TPP, you know, ring fencing China and creating norms with countries around China's periphery towards the goal of isolating China and trying to get them to accept our way of doing business. But Trump, with one little wobble at some point where he said something favorable to TPP, has not been inclined to that approach, obviously.
What did we make of the foreign policy conversation at the debate this week? Matt, I mean, obviously, we've had a turn in events that have made foreign affairs maybe more significant in this election. We saw Bernie Sanders basically making the case that he had been on the right side of these votes all along, that he opposed going into Iraq. But when you look at polling of Democratic primary voters, it looks like foreign policy is actually a very strong issue for Joe Biden.
Yeah, I mean, Joe Biden is seen as the person who has the most experience with the issue, which I think is unquestionably true. He was vice president. He chaired the Foreign Affairs Committee. Bernie Sanders' point, which I think there's also has a fair amount of merit to it, is that Biden did not always exercise that experience in the best way, right? And I do think this is a topic where the differences between the candidates probably matters more than on most of the stuff they've been talking about. I mean, I know healthcare is the most important thing to Democratic voters, but the contours of healthcare policy are going to be set by the United States Congress. Presidents really do have a lot of discretion in foreign affairs. I think it is much more likely that a Biden administration will see the U.S. military actively engaged in the Middle East, whereas a Sanders administration will be extremely hesitant to do that. Biden probably a little more hawkish than Barack Obama was. Sanders, I think, clearly less so. Elizabeth Warren is, I think, not have a super clear profile on this topic. And it's something that, you know, I've thought about a lot over the course of this campaign, because I think it's where the specific identity of the president matters most.
Felicia, to that point, do you think we've been learning much from these debates about the differences in the way these candidates would govern? What have you been taking away in terms of, you know, you can have differences in ideas? Which are the differences that are actually going to lead to different governance outcomes?
Well, I think one of the really striking things about all the candidates, even if you're going to bring in, you know, Klobuchar or Buttigieg, Biden, all the way to Sanders, is the similarities, broadly speaking, on a lot of their policy proposals. And I think Matt's right, you know, I think foreign policy is one place where we do see some distinctions, or rather some candidates more comfortable in thinking about international rule of law and use of military than others. And I think that's more a comfort level than a difference level at this point. But I think with respect to governing, you do see some people who want wholesale change, full stop, and you see other people who want to improve the system as it is. And I do think those are important approaches when you think to how they might actually wield government power if they had it.
Well, so Matt, this actually brings me in a funny way to your case for Sanders, because I think, you know, people wouldn't typically associate you as being someone who would be supporting Bernie Sanders in this primary. And I think people maybe take the piece as having a little bit of a trolling element. I'll let you say whether it does or not. But basically, you seem to be making the case that Bernie Sanders would be a unifying president for the party, because he would bring in some people who felt left out, but that also that he would be good at the sort of incremental policy change that he claims to be fomenting a revolution against.
Well, I mean, I think he would be okay at it. I think the experience of Bernie Sanders is a longtime member of Congress. I think some more moderately minded people hear what he's saying and they think, oh, my God, like this guy has no idea how Congress works. He has no idea how to get things done. But he clearly does. Like, he's been in Congress a long time. He has been there for Democrats on close votes when they need them. He's gotten little amendments in. He's done the occasional bipartisan bill with different people. I mean, he knows, right? The political revolution, it's incredibly inspiring to a subset of younger Democrats, and good for them. But I just would not be substantively concerned that he doesn't know how to legislate. Now, a difference, I mean, Felicia is too humble to say this, but, you know, one question is, like, which candidates are going to really look to places like Roosevelt when they're making decisions about how to staff the executive branch, and who would be more likely to sort of go back to the well from the Clinton-Obama type administration, where you had, you know, some progressive-minded people, but some people with closer ties to the business world. And I do think both Sanders and Warren clearly would be looking to get a more left-wing sort of group of people into the executive branch. Although, of course, even there, it's a question of, like, who can be confirmed. And I think the differences on domestic issues in practice just wind up amounting to less than fired-up partisans really want to believe.
Rich, I hear a lot of Democrats essentially talking themselves into the idea the electability is about the same for all the candidates that you could nominate. And we'll talk about the specific way that came up in the debate in a moment. But I guess, you know, as you watch these debates as a Republican, how are you feeling about who looks like the formidable general election candidate here?
I still think it's probably Biden. It's just I have a little less certainty than I did at the outset, and find myself squinting a certain way and having more sympathy to Matt's argument than I would have a couple of months ago. You know, enthusiasm matters, charisma, and Bernie has kind of an idiosyncratic charisma matters. It's just Bernie, I think, comes with so much baggage, calling himself a socialist, the foreign policy associations in the past, and just the sheer astonishing reach of his program would just create a lot of a lot of targets. But I have to say, I also felt myself just more sympathetic to him over the last week. I don't believe this Elizabeth Warren charge that he said that a woman can't get elected president. And that aside, I think the debate moderator handled that question extremely poorly, in a way unfavorable to Sanders. So for the first time ever, I've felt at least a whisper of sympathy for Bernie Sanders.
So what do we make of this episode? And in case anybody has not heard about this, there was a CNN report on Monday that at a meeting in December 2018, Bernie Sanders had told Elizabeth Warren that he didn't think a woman could win the 2020 presidential election. The CNN report had sources, including two people who said that Warren had described the conversation to them shortly after it happened. The Sanders campaign denied it. And then after some hours of not commenting, the Elizabeth Warren campaign put out a statement confirming that this exchange actually had happened. They gave differing accounts of it at the debate. And then after the debate, Warren walked up to Sanders and said, "You accused me of lying on national television," which got picked up by the mics, even though they were no longer broadcasting at that moment. So, Felicia, I mean, people talked about this non-aggression pact between Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders. This certainly seems like a breach of that. It never made a ton of sense to me. I mean, if Elizabeth Warren wants to be the nominee, she's behind Bernie Sanders in the polls. She has to do something to argue for his supporters to switch over to her.
And I actually think that on the stage, she did an amazing job of reminding people that with respect to electability, the women on that stage and not the men had actually been electorally successful. So, you know, until the hot mic moment, that was sort of the home run that all the commentators said, you know, that's the reason Elizabeth won the night. But I also want to make a further comment about this entire moment, because I think we should be talking about sexism and electability straightforwardly. And I just have 2 points on this, mostly cribbed from Rebecca Traister. So, you know, hats off to her. But the first thing is that engaging in a he said, she said back and forth really doesn't usually redound positively to the woman. We have seen that in many other cases, and we see that here. And so I just think that is an important thing to remember, especially when the Sanders side is saying, well, she's outright lying. But the second thing, and I think the most important point here, is that the charges of lying that are being thrown around by both sides are, yes, they're certainly counterproductive, but I also think they're kind of beside the point. Because you have to remember what Sanders himself said in that denial. He said, quote, "What I did say that night was that Donald Trump is a sexist, a racist, and a liar who would weaponize whatever he could." And I could imagine that if I'm Senator Warren hearing that, I might very well hear that Senator Sanders thinks I can't win the presidency. So I can imagine that both people think they are telling the truth.
Matt, doesn't this undermine the case of Bernie Sanders as the unity candidate? I mean, I think part of the significance of this dispute is that it brings up a lot of feelings about Bernie Sanders by certain people in the Democratic Party coalition, especially women who supported Hillary Clinton, who thought that there was a sexist aura around that campaign. And, you know, whether or not that is a fair assessment, I think it conceivably is something that makes it more difficult for him to unite the party than it might be for another candidate.
Yeah, I mean, my biggest point about this is that Sanders' weakness in the primary is with sort of strong partisan Democrats, right? People who have a big affiliation with the party itself, who naturally don't like that Bernie, like, won't put a little D next to his name, things like that. Whereas the people who Sanders likes, who like Sanders the most, are people who are at the margins of party politics, right? People who really might not vote, might vote third party, things like that. And you've always seen him. I mean, Vermont is a very blue state, so winning there is not a huge achievement. But he always runs ahead of Democratic presidential candidates because he's brought in Perot voters, he's brought in Green Party voters, he's brought in Libertarian voters to vote for him because there's a segment of people who like his sort of weird anti-partisan politics. It doesn't personally speak to me, but like I'm the kind of person who, you know, is going to vote for the Democrats sort of whatever they do. I mean, the particulars of this dispute are ugly, particularly because I think it's pretty clear what went on in the conversation, which is that Sanders articulated what was considered the woke position at the time, which was that sexism had really hampered Hillary Clinton in the campaign. But then you can turn that around and say, well, is he saying Democrats should never nominate a woman again? And this worried me at the time Hillary's campaign, sort of post-campaign, was so heavily emphasizing this idea that she'd been handicapped by sexism. Because I don't think the people saying that wanted voters to hear, let's never nominate a woman again. But it is what they were saying. And I think a lot of voters did hear it that way. And I don't think that's good for the country or for the party to put that message out.
Still with me are, on the left, Matt Iglesias of Vox, Rich Lowry of National Review on the right, and Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute is our special guest. And now it's time for Tweets of the Week. Sometimes it only takes 140 characters, or maybe 280, to distill the spirit of the week. Rich Lowry, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My Tweet of the Week is from at A.G. Hamilton, who tweeted a picture of the articles of impeachment being carried from the House to the Senate, and he tweeted, "I can't believe Pelosi just gave up all that incredible leverage she had over Mitch McConnell."
Felicia Wong, what's your Tweet of the Week?
My Tweet of the Week is from Benji Sarlin. Politics is in parallel universes now, in which a Sanders-Warren argument over a dinner conversation is legit one of the most dramatic moments on the D side, while on the R side, the president's allies are being implicated in an alleged plot to stalk a U.S. ambassador mid-impeachment.
Matt Iglesias, what tweet struck you?
Michael Brendan Doherty said, "Deeply envious of my mother, who lived in a world where it was just fine to leave your kid in his car seat in a locked car for 5 minutes and get something done."
My Tweet of the Week comes from Joe Perticone, who used to be my colleague at Business Insider. Joe tweeted before the announcement of the House impeachment managers, "For those who don't know how it works, the impeachment managers are selected through a pretty lengthy process. There's a skills challenge and obstacle course. Then, based on those results, it works NFL draft style, no lottery." The Guardian, in its digest of what was going on in impeachment news, then picked this up, apparently using this tweet to claim actually how the Pelosi would be choosing the impeachment managers, which is not what she was doing. Joe was making a joke. There's no combine. They're just chosen based on, I guess, how well they think they can argue in a courtroom-style environment. I've been talking with Matt Iglesias of Vox, Rich Lowry of National Review, and Felicia Wong of the Roosevelt Institute. We will be back to talk about the new progressivism. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center, I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Matt Iglesias, senior correspondent at Vox. And our special guest is Felicia Wong, president and CEO of the Roosevelt Institute. Felicia, the Roosevelt Institute has some new papers on what you're calling the new progressivism, an agenda that is to move beyond neoliberalism. So I guess my first question is what this is, and is this different from social democracy? Because it seems to me some of the key elements that run through this as themes are more fiscal redistribution, more direct government provision of services, a stronger government role in guiding the economy. Is this a return to views of the left on the economy as of, say, the 1960s?
There are actually four related strands of thinking. And by the way, this is based on a survey of over 150 academics, lawyers, economists. So this is a landscape of how many progressives are thinking right now. And what we say is that there are four different strands. The first strand is that we call the new structuralists. These are the people who start from the basic premise that government rules or the lack thereof structure markets. And if you want better markets, more competition, you need to actually take the structure of markets away from private companies and actually put it back in the hands of government. Government should step in to re-regulate so you get better competition. That's strand one. Strand two is a public provider strand, which says that, you know, markets actually don't deliver some social goods particularly well. And so if markets don't, then government should. So that's where you get education and healthcare, housing, transportation. Maybe some of these things ought to be actually provided by the government so you can get more universal access. You can correct for race and gender exclusions. So let me pause here to say that these two can actually actually be sort of related to two prominent candidates on the left. Elizabeth Warren is kind of a new structuralist. Bernie Sanders is kind of a public provider. And there's a lot of similarities between these two, but there's also a lot of, you know, there are some tensions, which we can talk about. The third strand is a strand that it actually in some ways goes beyond both of these to say, you know what government can do? Government can actually set the lodestar, the North Star for the economy, especially at a time of transition. The government can set the direction of economic change very productively. It can help lead us, for example, from a carbon-based to a decarbonized economy. And this is an argument that's at the heart of the Green New Deal. And then the fourth strand here says, well, if you're going to have government do good things, which is really what all of these three things have in common, the fourth strand says, then the government better be good and the government better be democratic small d and the government better actually have people able to weigh in. Now, there are lots of subtleties amongst these. A lot of the people who are in these various strands have plenty of debates with each other. But overall, this is the reason we call this post-neoliberal is it's basically taking the idea of power away from solely corporations and putting it back in the hands of people and also putting it back in the hands of other institutions, including labor institutions, other economic institutions.
So, Matt, I'm wondering what you think about that, and especially at this particular moment in the economic cycle, because, you know, we're at a period where for 2 years there's been significantly faster wage growth at the bottom of the income scale than at the top. We're starting to feel what it looks like to be at least close to full employment. And so I think, you know, historically there's been a lot of focus on monetary policy and that basically, you know, if the Fed screws up as it I think you can strongly argue that it has over the last decade and allow an output cap to be too large for too long, then you can have, you know, an economy that doesn't work for ordinary people. If you get that stuff right, it works a lot better. So I guess one question is, can a lot of this stuff be fixed at the monetary policy level? Or do we need, as Felicia describes here, do we need the government trying to set a direction for innovation and for the direction of the economy, that sort of thing?
I mean, I think it's a mistake to just sort of skip past the basics of macroeconomic management, because I do think that's been the most prominent thing in people's immediate lives. But, you know, these Roosevelt reports are tapping into, I think, some extremely valid points that there are important things that are not provided in even a well-functioning market economy, different kinds of social goods. And that my biggest question, though, is that I find the public provider approach to be very promising. I think it's compelling. I think there's a lot of sort of good ideas there. But then when you look in practice at publicly provided goods in the United States, you know, our mass transit construction, which I know is something you and I have both written about, our performance there is really, really bad, right? The New York City Housing Authority's actual performance does not make you think, well, what we need is a lot more housing like this. And so one thing that progressives are going to have to do if they want to make this agenda sail is focus on the difficult problem of, like, actually delivering publicly provided goods in an effective way. Now, we have some very effective public agencies in the United States. It's not impossible to do, but we're not doing it uniformly, and we're not the world leader in that sphere, I would say, which is, you know, the Nordic countries not only have a lot of public provision of services, but they do it well.
Felicia, what do you say to that?
Well, I think Matt's right, actually. You know, because we lay out as one strand of this multi-strand approach to new progressivism, because we lay out the idea that public provision should be central to part of how we think about solving social problems, that doesn't absolve any of us from the tough question of figuring out how exactly to do it. We actually do know that in some cases, the public can be excellent at providing things. I always think about, you know, California's higher education system, which when it was well funded, actually was an enormous engine of economic growth because it provided education at the top research university level, Berkeley, UCLA, and it also provided a lot of community colleges, all well funded. So just because problems are hard doesn't mean we can't try to solve them and that we can't try to solve them where smart with public provision.
So, Rich, while obviously the set of solutions that Felicia would be discussing here are generally not ones that people are going to be amenable to on the right, I think a lot of the problems that she's diagnosing and that she's talking about people on the left diagnosing are problems that are also identified increasingly by people on the right that you see with some of the populist turn that you see in thinkers influencing the Trump administration. And so I guess the question is, if not more redistribution, more regulation, what is the conservative populist approach to some of these problems about how the economy has failed to deliver for people up and down the income scale? What does that look like if it's not this left agenda, and it's also not a traditional neoliberal agenda?
Well, the populists are still working this out. A lot of it currently involves inveighing against the tech companies and talking vaguely about more regulation or even a breakup and some more attention to programs to support workers like the EITC. But I think basically, one, now we're in a pretty good place. I mean, this is, I think, a risk Democrats have is you listen to them in the debate stage and they don't seem to be describing the current economy. Now, it's true that last 20 years have been bad for people further down the income scale, in large part because of the hideous effects of the financial crisis. But what I would focus on and kind of a cost of living agenda, particularly focused on helping those kind of people, is we need cheap education, we need cheap healthcare, we need cheap housing. And a lot of the problems with these sectors has to do with either government limiting supply, which you see in housing, or with ill-considered government regulation. And then also another aspect of the discontent in the country, despite full employment, I think has to do with the erosion of institutions of civil society, including family and marriage. So I think any conservative approach to this also has to take that up.
Felicia, you talk in your paper about noises that one hears on the right that echo some of these ideas, but also have huge, maybe unbridgeable differences from left populists. And you talk about Tucker Carlson railing against profit-seeking elites, but also expressing racist or sexist or homophobic ideas. And I guess my question for you is, what is the practical implication here for building a political coalition? Do you need to win over some of the people who are on the right or who are sympathetic to those figures on the right, like Tucker Carlson, if you're trying to build a new populist agenda? And how do you bridge those gaps over, call it values or social issues or however you'd want to describe it?
Well, I think this is actually all about coalition building, but the first place that progressives really need to look is to build progressives amongst themselves. I mean, the new structuralists, the public providers, the people who think a lot about democracy, they actually have to recognize that they are all, that we are all on the same side of the movement, in the same movement, and we're on the same side of the fight. One of the things about progressive politics for the last 30 years is that people have been divided into issue silos around guns, around women's reproductive health, around labor, and all of these fights. One of the things we're trying to say in this paper is that all of these fights are actually genuinely the same fight. Now, with respect to right populists, it is very clear that you see a kind of anti-corporate rumbling amongst certain people on the right. We talk about Josh Hawley. We talk about Tucker Carlson. But it is absolutely not acceptable from a values perspective to have people like Carlson kind of weaponizing race and creating an exclusionary welfare state or an exclusionary anti-corporate stance. And I think it's very important for progressives to not be fooled by that.
So I guess the issue I would look to in this presidential campaign that I think, and Felicia and Matt, I'd like both of your thoughts on this, that I think reflects an effort to build a coalition around this is Medicare for All, where basically, you had a successful effort to get senators in the Democratic Party who were thinking about running for president to co-sponsor Bernie Sanders' bill on Medicare for All. You got people to commit to that rhetorically. But then once you started to have to discuss specifics of plans, how things were going to be financed, who would have to change their healthcare plans when, you saw a fracturing of that coalition, not even in a general election environment, but within the Democratic presidential primary. And so I'm wondering, what does that say about the ability to build consensuses on the left that are durable enough to go out and win general elections if it doesn't seem to have been possible to do that even on the sort of most salient issue in this campaign?
I think that illustrate some of the particular challenges with that proposal, which is incredibly ambitious and just a really, really, really big change, but also some of the problems with the primary process as a mechanism for sorting out policies, because ultimately it's like the candidates have to disagree with each other. There'd be no point in building a kind of consensus. But I actually think if you dive a little bit beneath the surface of the rancorous Medicare for All debate, what you have is the moderate Democrats coming around to what progressives had been saying at the origin of the Affordable Care Act process, which is that you need to create a strong public option into this mix. And I think that in their heart of hearts, the strongest Medicare for All advocates know that they are not going to be able to enact their sort of dream scheme, and that the plausible endgame of this is going to be something like a big public option initiative. And so I'm a little bit optimistic for the prospects of consensus there.
Yeah, Matt's totally right. I think that Medicare for All obviously is a central set of policies, but also a kind of red herring because it is so big and because it does represent a change, a smart change, but a change that feels big to people. And I think that everyone has actually come around to a kind of very large public option as a way of creating better competition in the market. And that is a consensus position now amongst Democrats.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
It's really astonishing that Nancy Pelosi, who isn't a Twitter personality or a cable news host, continues to insinuate that Donald Trump and even Mitch McConnell are tools of Russia, a charge that would be widely condemned as rank McCarthyism if anyone else were making it.
Felicia Wong, what's your rant?
In our primary system, we make people mostly on the same side argue against each other. And in that system, debate moderators control the narrative. And a lot of times, moderators repeat things in their questioning that are just wrong. In Iowa on Tuesday, we heard, quote, "Senator Sanders, your campaign proposals would double federal spending over the next decade. How would you keep your plans from bankrupting the country?" Well, attention, America. Spending money that we have, that wealthy and people and corporations have, on things that we desperately need would be good for the economy.
Matt Iglesias, what's your rant?
I'm here subbing for Liz Brunig because D.C. public schools are closed today for a weird teacher development thing, and she needs to take care of her child. I need to rush off right afterwards to swap with my wife to take care of ours. And this is a very bad way to run a public service. People need the schools to be open during normal, regular working school days. And people need to think about like some way to keep these services working. If teachers need time for professional development, we need some kind of extra camp or something people can do. It's like kids need some place to go during the day.
For my rant, last week, the Wall Street Journal ran an op-ed by Robert Weatherby, the CEO of Allegheny Technologies, which is a U.S. manufacturer of specialty metals. The headline of the piece is, "I support Trump's tariffs, but need an exemption." Now, I realize that headline sounds comical. He had a not totally crazy argument. He says the point of Trump's tariffs is supposed to be to support U.S. manufacturing employment, but that's not what they're doing at his firm. They're making the materials he needs more expensive to buy, and that means he may actually have to lay off workers. Now, that is too bad, but that is how tariffs work. Tariffs raise prices. They're supposed to raise prices. That's how it's possible for other U.S. firms to sell at higher prices. But if someone's selling at a high price, that means you have to buy at a high price. That's why tariffs hurt employment. They hurt the economy. And we should all get an exemption. Not just Robert Weatherby. None of us should have to pay these stupid metal tariffs. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Matt Iglesias, and Felicia Wong. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is J.C. Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.